That's great. Find yourself a Bible and turn up a little passage. Luke chapter 16. Can you find Luke 16 while you're there? Find Luke 16. As we carry on thinking about happiness. Happiness. Somebody told me about a song. Happiness, happiness. Da, da, da. Was it Ken Dodd? Yeah. My word, there you go. Not your obvious pop star, Ken Dodd, but there you go. But there's all sorts of songs about happiness. It's a big issue in our world. Lots of people send off their kids and say, whatever you do, dear, be happy. Before that, it used to say, be good, didn't they? But now it's be happy. So it's all changed. But we're in a series asking that question, what makes you happy? And we came up with two answers so far and see how you remember. What is the first answer? Oh, I've given it to you. There you go. What makes you happy?
Nothing.
No thing. Things do not make you happy because happiness is more about a who than a what. Happiness is always more about who than what. So no thing makes you happy. If that were true, you'd go out to Blue Water today and be ecstatic. And it won't last, will it? You'll have to go out and buy something else, and then something else, because it's just temporary, it's a quick fix. Doesn't make you happy permanently. No thing. What was the other thing that makes you happy? Sewing. Well done. Sewing. And we said, didn't we, that last week we looked at Jesus' teaching and we said happiness is an outcome. It's a result of something else, of other things. You sow and you reap your way to happiness, which is good news, because if you've sown and reaped your way through decisions and actions and behaviour that has led you to an unhappy life, you can do the reverse. You can sow and reap your way into a life that will make you happy. You can do that. It's possible to do that. Happiness is not immediately accessible. You have to sow for it. It's more farmer than programmer. You can't flick a switch. You have to sow some things, plant some things, water some things, keep looking after some things, and eventually there'll be a harvest of happiness. That's how it works. There's no other area where this applies more than what we're going to talk about today. And we don't often talk about this in church, because most people outside the church think the church is only interested in this. But actually, it is important that Christians talk about this, because Jesus talked about it a lot. There is no more area where this principle of sowing applies more than in the area of money and finance. That's where it works. So when we come to money, we've all heard the wisdom, haven't we? The wisdom is money won't make you happy. And we all hear that, don't we? And we all nod and we say, that's right, money doesn't make us happy. But let's be honest this morning. None of us believe that. It's true, isn't it? Let's be really honest. Honest, I mean, we go on a walk sometimes and we pass some very large houses on the way and I quip as we walk by. I say, yeah, but I bet they're not happy. And I know they're ecstatic as they get into their Porsche and drive off down the... I bet they're not happy. I'm just hoping they're not happy, but I bet they are. I bet they are. Be honest, none of us believe that phrase, money won't make you happy. When I hear money won't make you happy, I think, just try me. If there's a test, I'll sign up for that one and see what happens. That would be great, wouldn't it? Simple fact is this, there is a connection between happiness and money. You've heard it first in church. There is a connection between happiness and money. But where we get it wrong is this. We assume the connection is this one word. That the connection between happiness, your happiness and money is this word. Here's the word. More. We assume the more we have, the happier we will be. If I had more money, I'd be more happy. So to get you thinking about this, here's a couple of questions, just to see if that pans out. How much more money would it take to make you more happy? You ever thought about that? Because if that's true, if our happiness is dependent on more, then surely we should have a figure in mind. Surely there must be a point at which then I'll be happy. I hit that particular figure. What's the figure? How much more? In this series, we've said All happy people have one thing in common. They have peace. Peace with themselves, peace with others, and peace with God. So let me ask the question another way. Here's the same question another way. Thinking about this idea of more. How much more money would it take to give you peace? How much more would you need to give you peace? And I know the answer to that question. For every single person in the room, no matter whether you have no income or low income or high income, I know the answer to that. And the answer for all of us, when we think happiness equals more money, this is what we're thinking. We're thinking, how much more? More than I currently have. That's our general default answer. If I had more than I currently have, I will be happy in the future. That's what we think. That's what we believe. And throughout life, that's our sort of default answer. Now, there is a connection between your happiness, your peace, which promotes happiness, and money. There is a connection, but it is not that word more. It is not that word more. Because you know the fault with that already, don't you? You know people who have less than you have, who are happier than you. You also know people who are more than you have, who are more happy than you. So it doesn't seem to pan out. It seems to work both ways. It doesn't seem to be dependent on the amount. We know there is a correlation between money and happiness, but it is not more. Happiness and money actually connect around a different M word. It's not more. It's this word. Managed. That's where happiness and money connect. There is a connection, but it revolves around this. It's about managing your finances. It's not how much you have, but how you manage what you have that will determine whether you are going to be happy. It's not the amount, it's the management of that counts. And here's a little, this is what I want you to remember this morning. This is a good little point to remember if you walk away and remember nothing else. Try and remember this. Money contributes to your happiness if you manage it well. That is true. That is a fact. That is true. It contributes if you manage it well. And you remember we said anything that undermines your peace will undermine your happiness? If that's true, you have to conclude, if you mismanage your money, if you mismanage it, regardless of how much you have, that will undermine your peace. You know people, don't you, who have mismanaged their money. How peaceful are they about it? And therefore, how happy are they? So there is a connection. If you don't manage your money, here's what happens, it starts to manage you. Have you noticed that? It's like your finances are controlling your every move. If you mismanage your money, your money manages you. And when that happens, here's what happens in your life. You lose control. And anybody who feels they have lost control of their life loses their peace and their happiness immediately. Nobody is happy if they don't feel in control. Nobody. Here's what Jesus said about it. And this is from the verse you looked up. Have you found it? Have you found Luke 16, 10 to 13? Find Luke 16, 10 to 13, and this is what Jesus says about money. He says an awful lot about money in the New Testament. It's scary how often he mentions it. No one can serve two masters, for you will hate one and love the other. You will be devoted to one, and you will despise the other. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? Listen, most of us think we're free, that we don't have a master. Most of us believe we live in a democracy where freedom is a platform upon which we stand. And we think we're free until we have to pay that bill, or until we're committed to that 25-year mortgage, or until we have 30, someone mentioned, 30-year mortgage. Some of us, you know, we think we're free, and then we examine it in the light of our finances, and we feel we're maybe not as free as we thought we were. Jesus talks about these two masters. A master is someone who controls your freedom. He says this, you cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. Now, this is interesting. I always assumed the opposite of God is, who's the opposite to God? Satan. The devil. Yeah. And when I think of opposite of God, I don't think money. Yet Jesus is comparing two masters, and he doesn't mention the devil. He mentions money. Jesus says you can only serve one or two masters, God or money. The Greek word in our Bibles for that word money actually is a little bit broader than the word money. We think cash, don't we? But actually it's that old word. You know what the old world was? God and, begins with an M, but it's an odd word. Mammon, yeah. There's translation of the word mammon. And the word mammon doesn't just include your cash. It includes your stuff, your wealth generally. It includes those sort of things. All the stuff that you want and all the stuff that you have. It's a bigger word than just your money. So it's a bit more all-encompassing. And Jesus drops this bombshell. And I think it is a bombshell. Don't dismiss this. And Jesus is saying this, not me. Listen, this is it. The chief competitor for your devotion isn't Satan. Because that would be easy, wouldn't it? You'd just say no. Because you know he's the bad guy and you don't go there. The chief competitor for your devotion, says Jesus, isn't Satan. It's your stuff. And it's your desire to acquire stuff that gets your devotion. Now, there's probably a bit of a personal kickback there. A little bit of a personal kickback. I don't serve my stuff, and I certainly don't love money. I don't do that. And Jesus says, hang on a minute, look carefully at what I've just said to you. When I say love money, I mean be devoted to. Now that changes it, doesn't it? Because I don't love money, but am I devoted to it? My stuff, all this sort of stuff I want and have. To be devoted to is a strong attachment. That's what it means. To be devoted to something is to be strongly attached. To be devoted means that this thing becomes your primary filter for all of your decision making. That's what devotion is about. You may not believe you love money, but if we're honest, we are devoted to our stuff and a desire for it. We are. We live in a Western world, and I think it's almost impossible to avoid that with the advertising and the pressure in this consumerist society. It is almost impossible to avoid it. And when you honestly compare your devotion to this word money, this stuff that Jesus talks about, and our desire for it, and the money that gets us it, when you compare your devotion to that, to anything else, you will have to conclude, and I will have to conclude, there is a strong devotion there. And that's what Jesus says. And just to prove it, let me ask you a question. Here's a question. These are stupid questions, because I know the answer before you're going to ask it. Here we go. Question. Has your desire, a strong attachment, your devotion to, has your desire for something ever caused you to do something? Have you acted on the basis of that desire? Have you made decisions and choices on the basis? Yeah? Have you? Okay. Let's try the next one. Has your desire for something ever caused you to do something stupid? Notice there's no comma after something there. I'm not insulting everybody here. You know, cause you to do something stupid. That's not what we meant. Although we could. I nearly put the comma in, but I didn't, because I'm talking to myself as well. Have you ever done something stupid out of a desire for something? Stuff. What Jesus would call mammon. You know, all this gear, all this stuff that we want and the money that gets it. If you're anything like me, the answer would be, yeah, I bought a Renault Fuego once. That was a really bad idea. I don't know why I did that. And I regretted it the minute I'd done it. But I really wanted it. So I spent a ridiculous amount of money buying a clapped out Renault Fuego. Why? And did I regret it? Yeah. And was I stupid? Absolutely. Waste of my money. How has your desire for something ever caused you to do something you regret? You know, these are stupid questions, aren't they? Because everybody in this room is probably going to say a yes to each one of those. All this proves one thing, and I'm trying to convince you of what Jesus said is true. Convince you of this. Your desire for equals your devotion to. We've all done it. And it does prove, to some extent, our devotion to. That's what Jesus is saying. The love of money. In those moments, our desire, our devotion for money and stuff has mastered us. And we made that choice, that decision. And for some reason, it's not us, is it? It's that desire making that decision. It's like this inner force that pushes us to do stuff that we regret and we think is stupid later when we look back at it. We are no longer the boss in an odd sort of way. It becomes our master. And now you maybe have to pay the loan back, which you're stuck with for a long, long time. Or maybe now you've got that commitment that you can't get out of, but you've signed the paperwork and you've taken the money and you're stuck with it. Maybe now you've got a wardrobe full of clothes and you're still saying, I haven't got anything to wear. Maybe you're in that boat. But we've all had this devotion, this desire for stuff. And it's there. He knows, Jesus knows, the chief competitor for the throne of my life is my desire to acquire. It is. I'll be honest about it. It's often the chief competitor in my life. It actually has the power to enslave us. It makes us do silly things. It makes us do stuff we regret. And when you're enslaved, you lose control. And when you lose control, you are not happy to be out of control in your own life. No matter how much you have, it doesn't matter. You're just not happy. A bird in a gilded cage is still a bird in a cage. It doesn't matter how beautiful the cage looks. If you're on the inside of the bars, it's not a pleasant place to be. Why do we do this? I'll tell you why we do this. Here's the things we do. That's why we do this. That's what starts this whole cycle going on. That's what starts this competition for the throne of our heart. Our devotion to these things. Discontentment. Discontentment ensures I am never satisfied with what I have because I know what you have. And I know what there is to have. There has never been a generation on this planet that is more aware of what there is to have. Advertising is a $1 billion industry today. And they spend hours. There are people on the planet today who are working at it right now to make you discontent. That you do not have this. And we want to make you aware you don't have this. And we want you to have this. People, there is billions of dollars plowed into making you feel discontent. It's the truth. That's what advertising does. It makes you discontent. It's what it does. And the thing that drives that discontentment is this. It is awareness. Because if you're not aware, you're not discontent, are you? If you're not aware that there's something to have, you don't worry about it. As you become aware what's available and what others have, you become discontent. And as you walk through a shop, you become aware of that new gadget, don't you, gentlemen? And that addition to your home, ladies. And you think, I didn't even know that existed before today, but now I need it. Well, you don't need it. I want it. Now I want it. It takes 30 seconds, doesn't it, to go from, I didn't know that existed, to, I need it. Have you ever experienced that as you walk through a shop? We went to IKEA the other day. I hate IKEA because they know this about me. And they set their shop up. So I start at point A and I have to walk, literally, if you look at IKEA, it's designed. So you have to walk through everything in the shop. Have you noticed that? It's not like you go to aisle A, B or C. You have to walk through everything before you get, and I get to the tills and suddenly I've got a basket full of rubbish that I never intended to buy because I'm aware now it exists because I've had to walk past it. And now I've got to buy, I've never gotten out of IKEA without even the meatballs at the end, I buy them. And the hot dog, I saw a hot dog the other day at the end, right at the door on the exit. I thought, oh, I could really do with a hot dog. Really bad idea. Awareness breeds discontent. That's what it does. Another motivator behind all of this stuff is this word. Now, we don't like this word. Greed. Greed. None of us think we're greedy, right? None of us ever want to think we're greedy. None of us. Because you can't see greed in the mirror. Greed hides really well. But we have it. You know what? If you examine Jesus' words throughout the Bible and you say, what is greed really, Jesus? I think Jesus would say this. You need to dig around on Jesus' words about this. But this is what I think greed is really all about. Now, this collars me and this gets me. Greed is the assumption that it is all of it, is for my consumption. We think if it's placed in my hands, if it's mine, if it's given to me, then it's for me. That's greed. I have bad news. If you think what you possess and what you have and what's in your bank account and what, if you think it's just for you, that's greed in Jesus' definition. Because it's not. A, it's God's. And B, it's not just for you. But greed is that assumption. And we've all had that assumption, haven't we? That's mine. It's my money. My choice. My decision. Actually, that's greed. And that collars all of us. That gets us all, unfortunately, convicted of greed. We think if it's placed in my hand, it's for me. The problem is greed is an appetite, and you get a taste for greed, and that appetite grows. Greed just accumulates. So when money runs out, guess what happens? Because now you've got an appetite, but now you've got no bank balance left. What happens? We keep going, don't we? We keep going. Because it's so Middle Ages to think, I have no money, therefore I won't buy it. We live in a culture where I have no money, doesn't matter. I'll get it anyway. Loans and cards and hire purchase and contracts and, you know, all of this stuff. And we don't have to stop now. We can keep going with greed. We can keep it going. And that leads, as you know, greed ultimately leads to this other word that we really don't like, and that's called debt. That's the next step along the journey. Discontentment, born out of an awareness. And then we get greedy, don't we? And then we get into debt. Debt. Here's a mantra I want you to learn. This is a great little mantra I want you to learn as you go away. So a couple of things you might want to remember today. But they're on the piece of paper out the back as well. As on the, they'll be on the website when we upload it later today. But here's the... Oh, hang on. No, that was the mantra. There you go. I want is better than I owe. That's a great little mantra. Because you will want stuff. You'll see stuff. You'll be aware of stuff and you will want stuff. There's no doubt about that. Let's be honest. But I want is better than I owe. Here's why. Debt is what happens when you become a slave to your desire. A devotion to acquisition that leads to a loss of control, that leads to a loss of happiness. Debt does that. Another reason this is a good mantra is I want is between you and God. Have you ever thought about that? When you have that discussion between you and God about should I do this? Should I commit that money? Should I invest in that? Should I buy that? Should I, you know, you have that conversation with God. I want is between you and God, isn't it? That's good. But listen, the moment you buy something, it's not between you and God anymore, is it? Who's in between? Between you and your creditor. And what you do at that point, and this is fun really, because what you do at that point, you say, God, oh no, I've just bought that, that was a stupid, I know that was, I don't know, I was just, you know, this desire, this devotion to stuff, and I went and bought it, and I'm so sorry, God. And you wait, guess where you'll find God at that moment? You'll find him at the other side of the desk with your creditor, because God will say to you, you're a believer, you pay your debts. God now sides with your creditor, not with you. That's the truth. That's why I want is between you and God. I owe is between you and a creditor and God. Which one's better? Which one's better? Speaking personally, I have a rule that we try and live by. I learned it the hard way through our family history, really. Not my family, but there was sort of problems in our financial history as a family and when I was younger. And I stay out of debt. I learned the hard way, really, of what it looks like and the pressure and the stress that it invokes on a family that I grew up in. I live debt-free, and I've done that for decades because, well, why? I don't want to trade my freedom for stuff. And I don't want to trade my peace for something that cannot ultimately bring me peace. I've lived without any debt for decades. I have no credit card balances or anything like that. I don't owe anybody anything except the Lord. I owe him everything. And that's one debt I cannot pay, but one debt that I'm so grateful for, the only one. Here's a question, if I'm not convincing you. Discontentment, greed, and debt. Which one of these makes you happy? Which one of those makes you happy? So, here's the application. This is the simplest application I've ever given you as a church. You ready for it? You remember this. Here's the application. Stop. That's it. Got it? Stop. Stop with these three. That's the application. If you want to be happy, deal with these three. And stop. If you want to connect money to happiness, do away with all three of those. Try this question. What amount of money will it take to eliminate these three? Because money and happiness is about more, isn't it, we think. So how much will it take to eliminate all those three? None. The only thing that addresses these three is management, not more. Management, not more. How you manage your money, taking back control, is the only way you deal with those three things that are damaging your sense of peace and your happiness. And Jesus gives us two alternatives. Either submit your money and your stuff to these three things. You can do that if you want, says Jesus. Two masters, you pick one, and that's the money one. You can submit to that one, or you could submit to God. Which one are you going for? You can say, God, I don't want my money to manage me. I want you to manage me. And Jesus suggests that we change our master. And if you take everything that Jesus in the Old Testament taught about money, you condense it down to a couple of words, really. When Jesus says, how do you handle money? How do you manage money? This is what he's talking about. These two words, generosity and wisdom. If you talk to happy people about money, I'll guarantee you they do both of those with regard to their stuff and their money. They're generous people and they're wise. And when you compare the list, that list, with the other three, discontentment, greed and debt, which list would you rather be on the side of? Would you rather be on the side of that? Would that make you happy? Or would the other list? Which one? If you want to connect money and happiness, here's how. Let me give you a little aid memoir to put this in practice. And this is basic financial management for believers, okay? This is God's advice to you. And it is exactly the opposite of the way the world works. But it is the connection to happiness with regard to money. Here's what you need to do. Three words. You need to give, you need to save, and then you need to live. Give. So every time you get your money. Are you paid monthly? Most people are paid monthly. Some still may be paid weekly, but you're paid monthly or whatever. Every time you get your money, you say, you are not the boss of me. I am not devoted to you. So how do you prove that? You give it away. Seriously. It's the only way you prove you're not severely attached to this stuff is you have to give it away. That proves it. I'm not attached to you. So you give first, you save second, and then you live on what's left. That is the Christian economic principle. That's how you do it. So give first. And when you don't, listen to this, this is really important. You don't give when there's an appeal in church. You don't give when someone says, we got $4,000 for Ben's tuition and we haven't got much of it so far. We need $4,000 and it's not there. Can we please? Technically, it shouldn't amount to say that. We give first. We give automatically. That's how we should operate as believers. Give first, not when an appeal is made. Automatically give as soon as your money arrives. Decide on the amount, decide on where, and put it in straight away. Send it out straight away. I give my tithe to God. I give my tithe straight away. I usually give a 24-hour delay just in case, you know, it was a weekend or a bank holiday or something like that, and I go into debt or something because I've given out money and there's none in there. But I give it as soon as I physically can after my paycheck arrives. And you guys are paying me. So you guys, you know, you fund, you allow me to conduct my ministry. It's not a salary, it's a stipend, which means you allow me, you release me to serve God. That's what you're doing by doing that. But when that money comes in, I say, actually, this is not my money, it's God's money. So it's going straight out again, and a lump of it goes straight back. It's the greatest discount scheme you've ever had. You give me money, I'll give you it back. It's great, isn't it? Am I a mug? I don't know. But that's the way it works. But you give first. You give first. Because here's the truth. If you wait to give to the end of the month, what happens? There's nothing left. There's always something else that you could spend that money on. So if you don't give first, you won't give at all. And you certainly won't give with any significance. Give first. With giving, here's the mantra. You snooze, you lose. You will not give if you wait and you leave it. The minute you get your money, give. Give. Second, save. This is the second thing you do. So the first thing you do, you got your money, you haven't spent anything yet, you've just given. Second thing you do is you put some aside. You put some in that savings account. Same principle. You will never, ever save money. You ever struggle to save? Here's why. Because you wait until you see what's left at the end of the month and then you try and save. Doesn't work. You save second. Give to God. Then you put money aside. Third, you live on whatever is left. Whatever you, after you have decided to give and where, and after you've decided to save and where, you live on what's left. This is the exact opposite of how most people conduct their finance. What do most people do first? They live. And then they pray there's enough to save and to give at the end of it. As a church, we want something for you more than we want something from you. And I know we're talking about money and it's always a sensitive issue. But I want something for you more than I want something from you. So if you've done this the wrong way around and you've lived and you've never saved and therefore you've never given because you've never had anything left because you've just used it all on living, here's what you need to do. You've probably accumulated debt. My advice to you, the first thing you need to do if you're in that boat and your life is out of control and you owe money, clear the debt. First thing, beyond giving and saving, clear your debts. Clear your debts. That's what I would advise you to do. And this adds to your happiness. This really does add to your happiness. Do you want a proof? Here you go. Giving always results in joy. It does. It's wonderful to give. It really lifts you to give and be generous to people. Savings in the bank always amounts to peace. Because when that bill comes in, that unexpected thing, it's okay. I don't have to worry about it. And when you choose to live on the rest, you are choosing to be financially free. And freedom brings happiness. Those three things will bring you happiness. They work. They work. And I would rather have joy and peace and freedom than that house or that car or that holiday. I would rather have those three words than anything else in my life. More money won't get you those three things: joy and peace and freedom. This is how you make your money make you happy. This is how you do it, by managing it well. Because I don't imagine if you've been living, just imagine if you've been living like this for 10 or 20 years. If you've been living like that, giving first, saving second, living on what's left. Imagine what is happening to your finances and how your happiness level if you've been living like that for a long period of time. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be great? Some of you are probably already doing it. I don't have to imagine. I've lived that for decades and it works. And the last thing to damage my happiness is finances. It never bothers me. Well, I tell a lie. Sometimes it bothers me. But, you know, that's usually because of awareness and I'm looking over my shoulder and comparing what I've got to other people. That does sometimes bug me. But then I have to remind myself of this. And these are more important. It's the same principle from week two. What makes you happy? Sowing. And if you sow in this way, over a protracted period of time, I guarantee you'll be happier than you are now. Because money does contribute to your happiness if you manage it well and manage it the way God says you should. And your best option is to invite your Heavenly Father to manage you as you learn to manage your money, to make Him your master, not the money. That's how you keep money from managing you. You submit to Him and you do it His way. That's how it works. Invite God to be your master, your manager. Would you consider living like that and seeing what you sow in terms of happiness in 5, 10, 15 years' time? We're going to come to communion and share communion in a moment.
Can I just give a word of
testimony? Yeah, sure.
Years ago, part of my student course was you had to work. It was a sandwich course. So I got my first wage as a student. And I remember coming home, I mean, it was a long time ago, I think it was £21 because I was 20 years of age. It was the highest paid you could get at 20 in horticulture in those days. And the first thing I come home on a Friday, in those days, you just get paid with real money, you know, the queen on the back and all that sort of stuff. And I'd come home, I was staying with my uncle, and I had to pay I paid him some money for keep. Put that on I can see it now on the dressing table, and then my tithe was put on there, because I'd only been a Christian about a year, but tithing was, that's what you did. It's obvious, you want to give back to God, He'd given you so much. And we went out Friday night, and had a great time, and Saturday night, yeah, it was fantastic. And then when I came back on Saturday night, I saw the van, I had a little van then, that I wasn't having enough petrol for the week, because we got paid weekly. And the money was sitting there. I'd given my aunt had the money, but the tithe was sitting there I thought, I can't really give this tomorrow, because I haven't got any petrol, I can't get to work. I've got to get to work. And I thought, no. And I got up on the Sunday morning, and I took it, and I put it in the offering plate. And I thought, oh, well, it's up to you, God, now. The tank of my Morris 1000 was a quarter full. And I knew I needed a whole tank to last the week, the amount of driving. The whole of that week, it stayed at a quarter full. I got to work on Friday morning, and we got paid on Friday morning. I got in the car Friday afternoon to drive home. It was on empty. And I got to the garage about a quarter of a mile away and filled up. I've never, ever forgotten that. God was so gracious, because really I should have been walking to work, even though it was 7 miles. But he taught me a lesson. And that doesn't mean to say he's always bailed me out of every mistake and stupid thing I've done. But I've never forgotten that. So I really identify with that. Even though, you know, it seemed a crazy thing. I think if we honour God, He'll never, ever let us down. Even if I had to walk, that would have been a blessing in some strange way, but yeah. 7 miles every morning at 7 o'clock wasn't the best thing to do. So he was, so yeah, just, what was the ship?
Yeah, that's good.
Can I add to that, Bill?
Yeah, sure, mate.
Just to say that when we came back from Peru years ago, I came back to this country without a job, without a house to go to, without a car, no schools for children. There's a little verse in the Bible which says, "My God will supply all your need." And as we got off the plane, my parents were there. Some of you know this, but not everyone. And my parents said to me, "Oh, we found your house. It's rent-free." For a year we lived in Cheam. Within a fortnight I had got a job in Oxford, which meant that the children could go to school here, and we also bought a car. So in that year we commuted and we had to look for a house in Oxford. The boys in primary school, talking to their friends, one of the friends said something to his mother. The mother knew that there was a house free, for sale, I mean, not free, for sale.
That's right.
East Hill Road. And as a result, she phoned Anne, my wife, and we came and had a look at it. They wanted 27,000. Not much now, but in those days, more than I could afford. So we said, "Well, thank you very much, but we've only got 21. So we left it. They came back a week later and said, "Look, a different reason I wanted to tell you now, but we're going to put it on the market for 23, but if you want it, you can have it." So I again said, "Well, that's very nice, but we can only afford 21. "Okay," they said, "you can have it for 20. "My God will supply all your needs," and I found that true all my life.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those risks you have to start taking to work, to realize it works. There's some stuff you think, I want to know it works before I do it. With giving, the only way to know it works is to do it. In Clevedon, we challenge the church to give first to God, and through that we built a building that was worth 2 million, that cost us 2 million quid, and it was entirely funded by 200 people, 2 million quid. You do the maths. And here's the weird thing. By giving more, I somehow end up with more disposable income. It feels like my finances are freer now than they ever have been. Giving doesn't seem to have been a problem. It seems to have made my life better, not worse. But you'll never know it unless you do it. Malcolm's out there looking after the kids this morning. He'd love it if you went up to him and say, "I need to review my tithing." I'd encourage you to do it. I think you need to do it this way. Give first. That's why God, even the Bible, it says the first fruits, you know that? God in the Old Testament talks about the first fruits. I always thought that was, well, I'll give him the best stuff. But actually it's the first, the key word is first. It's my first thing I do with what God has given me, I give it back in acknowledgement that he is the source of everything I have. And when I do that, the rest starts fitting into place. And it does affect your happiness, it really does. Yeah. I'd encourage you to go home, talk as couples and ask the question, are we doing it this way? Or are we living first and the rest gets bundled to the back? Because that's not what Jesus said to do. I'll be honest, it's not what Jesus said to do. And if you're a follower of Jesus, then follow him in this. Follow him in this. And that way the kingdom will be really blessed because of you. And you'll know it. You'll be happy about that. I mentioned I'm debt-free. You know why I'm debt-free? One, I don't take loans and fill up credit cards and stuff. The other reason I'm debt-free and brings me great joy is because of what we're going to do next. I'm debt-free because Jesus has paid mine. And there's a huge amount of happiness and peace about that for me. Debt is in all sorts of ways, isn't it? And we're going to celebrate communion right now, and we're going to come to that. But should we just sing before we do? And there's a song I'd like you to think about. Above all powers. Is he, we talk about devotion for your life. Is he above all wealth? That's what the song says. Above all wealth. Above everything I own. Above all of that, he is more precious to me. Is he your true wealth? Is he your immeasurable gift, as the Bible calls him? And we're going to spend some time remembering how he has made us debt-free in one aspect of our life. Maybe we can follow that through into other areas of our life too. But let's stand and let's sing about this glorious God, this immeasurable gift of God.